climbed down and went to talk to the barman. Conversations resumed slowly. The dancer went back a little stiffly to what she was doing with the two boas. People drifted to the bar, a few at first, then the bulk of those present. Bryant appeared to know a couple of them. Chris was introduced, promptly forgot names, and cornered Mike. What did Troy mean about being related to William? Bryant shrugged. Search me. Troy knows a lot of people. What are you drinking? And so it went on, the night swelling with noise and hilarity for a while, and then paring down again as people left. Chris's high began to flatten into something more reflective. Julie Pinion went home in a cab, the young executive she'd been arguing with in smug tow. The driver of one of the other cars announced his imminent departure around 3 a.m., and most of the remaining Shawn crew went with him. By 4, the party was down to one table. Chris and Mike, an off-duty Troy Morris, and a couple of the floor show dancers, now dressed and divested of most of their garish makeup. One introduced herself as Emma, and lurching into the toilets, Chris had to wonder if she was the object of the fellatio-inspired graffiti gouged there amid the political commentary. When he got back to the table, Emma had gone, and Troy was leaving with her colleague. The gun bag from his doorman duties was dumped on the table, the sawn-off and Chris's Nemex nestling together in the canvas folds. Chris joined in the round of farewells, and there was much drunken promising to keep in contact.
"Yeah," said Troy, pointing at Chris. "You should write, Faulkner."
He left, chortling inexplicably, with a shotgun slung over one shoulder and his other arm around the dancer's waist. At that moment Chris found himself possessed of a powerful desire to be Troy Morris, walking out of the Falkland into an entirely simpler, and, to judge by the black man's laughter, more joyous existence. He slumped into the chair opposite Bryant.
"I," he pronounced carefully, "have drunk far too much."
"Well, it's Friday."
Bryant's attention was focused on heating a stained glass pipe.
"Switch horses. Try some of this."
Chris's eyes tightened on what the other man was doing.
"Is that—"
Bryant's eyes shuttled sideways above the pipe and lighter, narrowed irritably.
"Ah, come on, man, lighten up. Just a little drive, right?"
The contents of the pipe smouldered and Mike inhaled convulsively. A shudder ran through his suited form. He made a deep, grunting sound and his voice came out squeaky as he offered the pipe.
"So, how does it feel?"
Chris frowned, confused. "What?"
"Conflict investment, a week in. Go on, take it. How's it feel?"
Chris waved the pipe away.
"No, thanks." "Pussy."
Bryant grinned to defuse the insult and drummed impatiently on the table.
"So tell me, how's it feel?"
"What?"
"Conflict fucking investment."
"Oh," Chris marshalled his sludgy thoughts.
"Interesting."
"Yeah?" Bryant seemed disappointed.
"That all?" "It's not so different from emerging markets, Mike."
Trying to think was hard work. Chris began to wonder if he should have accepted the pipe.
"Longer-term outlook, but basically the same stuff. Yeah, I like it, apart from that bitch Hewitt." "Ah, I wondered how that was going. Had a run-in, have we?"
"You could say that." Bryant shrugged.
"Hey, don't let it get you down. Hewitt's been that way as long as I can remember. It's always been harder to cut it as a woman in this field, so they come out twice as tough. They have to. See, these days, Hewitt practically is conflict investment. Big reorganization about 5 years back. Austerity measures. Division got cut to the bone. There's a lot of pressure to make good, and most of that pressure falls on Hewitt's shoulders."
"Notley's senior partner."
"Notley?"
Bryant piped more smolder.
"Nah. It was his baby in the beginning, but once he went senior, he downloaded everything onto Hewitt and Hamilton. There was another guy, Page, but Hewitt called him out just before profit share last year. Rammed him right off the gullet. Believe that?"
"The gullet?"
"Yeah, you know. Last section as you come up over the zones on the M11. The two-lane narrows. Where you took out that no-namer, or just after the underpass, where it goes elevated. Hewitt let Page get ahead there, knew he'd have to either slow down or turn around to face her. No chance of just being first to work these days. You've got to turn up with blood on your wheels or not at all. So, yeah, she lets him go. Waits. He's not good enough to make the 180 turn on a piece of road that narrow, so he slows up, tries for a side-to-side. She won't let him, just rams him off on a corner. Bam!
Bryant gripped the pipe in his teeth and slammed fist into open palm.
Page goes through the barrier, falls right into a low-rise, goes through 7 levels of zone housing like they were paper. Gas supply ripped open somewhere in one of the apartments on the way down. Boom, adios muchachos. Everybody in black.
Jesus.
Yeah, pretty fucking impressive, huh?
Mike squinted at the pipe, tried the lighter again.
See now, what Hewitt did, that's okay, but now she's got to prove that she doesn't need 2 junior partners to help her run CI. If she can't, it means she made a bad call. Pure greed call. No one around here minds greed, just so long as it's good for the company as well. If it works out for Hewitt, she's saved Sean the expense of a junior partner, and she and Hamilton get bigger equity. It's a free market trade-off. Something for us, something for them. But if it doesn't work out, she's dead in the water, and she knows it.
Well, Ms. Conflict Investment doesn't have a whole lot of confidence in me, Chris said gloomily. Not bloody enough for her, apparently.
That what she said?
Bryant shook his head.
Shit, after what you did to Quain, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, let's just say that not all my challenges have been that uncompromising. This kill-or-be-killed stuff is strictly for the movie makers. It's crude, man. You don't always need a kill. That's crude. Chris leaned forward as his enthusiasm kindled. You ever see any of those old samurai movies?
Bruce Lee? Shit like that?
No, no, not those. This is other stuff, older, more subtle. See, these 2 guys, they're about to have a duel, so they both stand there, swords out. Chris thrust with an imaginary sword, and Bryant jerked back in reflex. His eyes narrowed momentarily, and then he laughed.
Whoops, scared me there.
Sorry, wasn't intentional. So, yeah, the 2 of them stand there, and they stare into each other's eyes. He locked gazes with Bryant, who emitted another snort of laughter. They just stare, because they both know that the one who blinks or looks away first, that's the one who would have lost that fight. Bryant's laughter dried up without fuss. He set the pipe aside. Both men were leaning on the table now, drilling their gazes into each other's eyes with chemically altered concentration. The shared stillness of the moment stretched. The sounds of the bar receded into a backdrop, surf on a distant beach. Time ran on like a train they had both just missed. The pipe smouldered quietly to itself on the scarred wooden table. Vision wired their stares over it, eyeball to eyeball. From somewhere, an internal silence leaked into the world. Mike Bryant blinked. Mike Bryant laughed and looked away. The moment blew away like an autumn leaf, and Chris sat back with a look of tipsy fulfillment on his face. Bryant grinned a little intensely. Chris was too drunk to catch the upped voltage. Bryant made a pistol of thumb and forefinger. He pointed at Chris's face.
Bang!
The laughter bubbled up again, this time from both men. Bryant made a sound between a snort and a sigh.
There you are. You stared me out.
Chris nodded.
But I blew your fucking head off.
Yeah, Chris leaned back across the table, enthused, oblivious to the edge sheathed in the other man's voice.
But you see, there was no need for that. We'd already established the winner. You blinked, I would have won.
Bullshit. Maybe I had a hair in my eye. Maybe all these samurai guys walked away from fights they could have won just because they had a jumpy eye muscle that day. Would you read all this shit anyway?
Mike, you're missing the point. It's about total control. It's a duel between 2 whole people, not just 2 sets of skills. We could have a fist fight, and you could turn up with a gun. We could have a gunfight, and you could come with an armored car and a flamethrower. That's not what a duel's about.
Bryant picked up the pipe again. Duel's about winning, Chris, he said. Chris wasn't listening.
Look at China. A couple of centuries ago, there were cases there where two warlords sat down on the battlefield and played chess to decide the outcome of a battle. Chess, Michael. No death, no slaughter, just a game of chess, and they honored it.
Bryant looked skeptical.
Chess?
Just a game of chess. Chris was staring off into a corner. You imagine that?
Not really, no.
Bryant stuffed the pipe into a pocket and started to get up.
But it makes a good story, I'll give you that. Now, how about we get the car and get out of here before the sun comes up, because Suki's going to fucking take me apart if I don't get back soon, and she's not into chess.
Chapter 6 They came out of the Falkland through a side door and onto a different street. Cold night air like a slap in the face, and for a couple of moments Chris reeled. He wondered how Bryant was dealing with the pipe high.
Where's the fucking car?
This way.
Bryant grabbed him by the arm, dragged him around the corner, and started across the deserted street. Halfway there, he jammed to an abrupt halt.
Oops,
he said softly. The BMW sat on the far side of the street under one of the few working street lamps. Sitting on the car, four men and one woman, all dressed in oil-smeared jeans and jackets. The grime was a uniform, the pale, silent faces style-coordinated accessories. Heads shaven and tattooed, feet heavily booted, hands filled with a variety of blunt metal implements. None of them looked over 18. They stared at the two suited men on the other side of the street and made no move to get off the car.
"You've got to get your contact stunner fixed, Mike," Chris sniggered, still drunk. "Look at the shit you get all over it if you don't have it powered up."
"Shut the fuck up," hissed Bryant.
The female contingent of the carjackers levered herself off the hood of the BMW with sinuous grace.
"Nice car, Mr. Zective," she said solemnly. "Got the keys?"
Bryant clutched automatically at his pocket. The woman's eyes flickered to the move and locked on. She nodded in satisfaction.
"Get off my fucking car," Bryant barked.
The remaining four jackers obeyed in unison, arms spread and filled with their makeshift weapons. Chris glanced sideways at his companion.
"Bad move, Mike. You carrying?"
Bryant shook his head almost imperceptibly.
"In the car, remember? You?"
"Yeah."
Chris paused, embarrassed.
"But it's not loaded."
"What?"
"I don't like guns."
"See, it's like this."
The woman's voice jerked Chris back from the disbelieving expression on Bryant's face.
"Either you can give us the keys and your wallets and your watches, or we can take them from you. That's our best offer."
She lifted thumb and little finger solemnly to ear and mouth, making a child's telephone.
"Sell, sell, sell."
Bryant muttered something out of the corner of his mouth.
"What?"
Chris muttered back.
"I said, back the way we came and fucking run."
Then he was gone, sprinting flat out for the corner they had just rounded. Chris went after him, flailing to stay upright in the Argentine leather shoes. Behind him, the incentive, sounds of yells and booted pursuit. He leveled with Bryant and found, incredibly, that the other man was grinning.
"All part of a night out in the zones," he gritted. "Try to keep up."
Behind them, someone ran a metal wrecking bar along a concrete wall. It made a sound like a gigantic dentist's drill. They looked at each other and put on speed. Three streets away from the Falkland, the neighborhood plunged from run down to rotted through. The houses were suddenly derelict, unglassed windows gaping out at the street and tiny gardens full of rubble and other detritus. Chris, brain abruptly adrenaline-flushed and working, grabbed Bryant and yanked him sideways into one of the gardens, over piles of junk, scrambling, in past a front door that someone had kicked in long ago. Weeds grew up waist-high in the gap it had left. Beyond, a narrow, darkened hallway ran parallel to a staircase with half the banisters torn out. At the end, a tiled room that breathed stench like a diseased mouth. Chris leaned cautiously against the staircase and listened to the yells of the carjackers as they ran past and down an adjacent street. Bryant was bent over, hands braced on his knees, panting.
"You mind telling me," he managed hoarsely after a while, "why you're carrying an unloaded gun around with you?"
"I told you, I don't like guns. I don't like Louise Hewitt telling me what to do."
"Man, after 5 days, that's a bad attitude to have. I wouldn't go telling anybody things like that if I were you."
"Why not? I told you, didn't I?"
Bryant straightened up and looked hard at him.
"Anyway, where's your gun, Hotshot?"
"At least it's loaded."
"All right. Old piece of folk wisdom coming up."
Chris gulped his breath back under control.
"A gun in the hand is worth half a fucking million locked in the car."
"Yeah, you're right."
Bryant's grin flashed in the gloom.
"But I wasn't expecting this kind of trouble. We're only a couple of clicks inside the zones. These guys are out of their territory."
"You think they know that?"
Chris nodded out toward the street where voices were coming back. Some of the Jacker gang at least were retracing their steps. He jabbed an urgent finger upward, and Bryant took the creaking stairs into the darkness at the top. Chris slid back along the hallway toward the tiled room and sank into the shadows there. The stench enveloped him. The floor was slimy underfoot. He tried not to breathe. A moment later, two of the Jackers were standing where he had just been. Both were armed with long crowbars.
"I don't see why we need the keys anyway. Why not just smash the fucking window?"
"Because, moron, this is a BMW Omega series."
The other Jacker cast a doubtful glance up the stairs.
"State of the fucking art corporate gem jar. These mothers have alarms, engine immobilization locks, and the broadcast screen to the nearest retrieval center. You'd never move it 100 meters down the fucking street before they got you."
"We could still smash it anyway. Rip it up."
"Roof, you got no fucking ambition, man. If it weren't for Molly, you'd still be smashing up telephone points and throwing stones at cabs. You could have think bigger than that. Come on, I don't think they came in here. Too much chance of getting their suits dirty. Let's—"
Chris's foot slipped, knocked against something that rolled on the tiled floor. Clink of glass. Chris gritted his teeth and slinked one hand down to the butt of his empty gun. The two Jackers had frozen by the door.
"Hear that?"
It was the ambitious member of the duo. Chris saw a silhouetted wrecking bar raised in the faint light from the doorway.
"Okay, Mr. Zective. Game over. Come out. Give us your fucking keys and maybe we'll leave you some teeth."
The two Jackers advanced down the hall. They were about halfway when Mike Bryant dropped through a gap in the banister rail above. He landed feet first on the head of the gang wit, bringing up the rear. The two of them tumbled to the floor. The lead Jacker whipped around at the noise, and Chris exploded from his hiding place. He punched hard, high driving for the face and low for the guts. The Jacker turned back too late. Chris's high punch broke his nose, and then he folded as the solid right hook sank into his midriff. Chris grabbed the gang wit's shoulders and ran his shaven head sideways into the staircase wall. Up ahead, he saw Bryant reel to his feet and stamp down hard on the other Jacker's unprotected stomach. The gangwit moaned and curled up. Bryant kicked him again, in the head.
"Motherfucker! Touch my car, you fucking piece of shit!"
Chris laid a hand on his shoulder. Bryant hooked around, face taut.
"Whoa, it's all over."
Chris stood back, hands raised.
"Game over, Mike. Come on. There's only three left now. Let's try for the car again."
Bryant's face cleared of its fury.
"Yeah, good. Let's do it."
The street outside was quiet. They checked both ways, then slipped out and loped back toward the Falkland, Bryant navigating. Less than 5 minutes to relocate the corner pub, and the BMW sat gleaming pristinely under the street lamp as if nothing had happened. They circled the vehicle warily. Nothing. Bryant produced his keys and pressed a button. The alarm disarmed with a subdued squawk. He was about to open the door when the shaven-headed woman stepped out of the shadows of a doorway less than 5 meters away, a piece of iron railing raised in ironic greeting. She put her fingers to her mouth and whistled shrilly. Another jacker, similarly armed, stepped out of another doorway up the street and ambled down to meet them. The woman smiled at Bryant.
"Thought you'd be back. Now, you want to throw me those keys?"
In the moment that her eyes were fixed on Bryant, Chris produced his empty gun and leveled it at her.
"All right, that's enough," he snapped. "Back off."
The other jacker took a step forward, and Chris swung the gun to cover him, willing him to believe.
"You too. Back off, or you're dead. Michael, get in the car."
Bryant opened the door. Chris was feeling for the door handle on the other side when the woman spoke.
"I don't think that gun's loaded."
She took a step forward, followed by her companion. Chris brandished the Nemex.
"I said back off."
"Ah, you would have shot us by now. You're bluffing, Mr. Zek."
She raised her piece of railing, took another step forward, and Mike Bryant stood up from his side of the car, Nemex in hand.
"I'm not bluffing," he said mildly, and shot her 3 times in the chest and stomach. Boom, boom, boom.
The sound of the gun in the quiet street echoes off houses. Chris saw and heard it in fragments. The woman kicked back 2 meters before she dropped, the railing out of her hand and flying to clatter and roll across the camber of the street into the gutter. The other jacker, hands raised placatory, backing away. Face implacable, Bryant put the next 3 shots into him.
Boom, boom, boom.
He reeled and spun like a marionette, crashed into the wall and slid down it, leaving gouts of blood on the brickwork.
"Mike!"
The sound of pounding feet. The final member of the gang, summoned by the gunshots, sprinting across the street toward the fallen bodies. He seemed oblivious to the 2 men in suits. He hit the ground on his knees next to the woman, disbelieving.
"Molly! Molly!"
Chris looked across at Bryant. "Mike, let's—" Bryant made a sideways, hushing gesture with his free hand and lowered his aim.
Boom! Boom!
The kneeling boy jolted as if electrocuted, and then keeled slowly over the woman on the ground. Blood ran out over the street and trickled down to join the crowbar in the gutter. The echoes rolled away into the pre-dawn gloom like reluctant applause. They drove back to the checkpoint in silence, Chris wrapped in numb disbelief. The guard let them through with a cursory glance. If he smelled the cordite from Mike's gun, he said nothing. Bryant waved him a cheerful good night and accelerated the big car away into the well-lit canyons of the financial district. He was humming quietly to himself. He glanced across at Chris as they were approaching the Shawn block.
"You want to sleep over at my place? Plenty of space."
The thought of the hour-long drive back home was abruptly unbearable. Chris mustered a dried-out voice.
"Yeah, thanks."
"Good." Bryant speeded up and cornered west. Chris watched the towering blocks begin to thin out around them. As the BMW picked up the main feeder lane for the London Orbital, he turned slightly in his seat to face Bryant.
"You didn't have to kill them all, Mike."
"Yeah, I did."
There was no animosity in Bryant's voice.
"What else was I supposed to do? Fire warning shots? This symbolism of combat shit you talk about doesn't work with people like that. They're gangwit scum, Chris. They don't know how to lose gracefully."
"They'd already lost. And they were kids. They would have run away."
"Yeah, yeah, until the next time. Look, Chris, people like that, civilized rules don't apply. Violence is the only thing they understand."
Outside the hurrying car, the sky was brightening in the east. Chris's head was beginning to ache. Chapter 7. Chris awoke with a horrified conviction that he had been unfaithful to Carla. Liz Linshaw was sitting up in bed beside him, buttering a piece of toast and wiping the knife casually on the sheets.
"Breakfast in bed," she was saying authoritatively, "is so sexy."
Chris looked down at the stains she was making and felt a hot lump of mingled guilt and sadness swelling in the base of his throat. There was no way he could hide this from Carla. He opened his eyes with a jolt. Daylight strained through chintz curtains just above his head. For a moment the chintz hammered home the dream. Carla hated the stuff with a passion. He really had gone home with Liz Linshaw then. He turned on his side with a blockage of unshed tears still jammed in his throat, and he was in a single bed. He propped himself up, confused. Matching chintz quilt and pillowcase. Massive hangover. Close behind this sensory surge, the events of the previous evening crashed in on him. The street, the jackers, Bryant's gun in the quiet night. The relief made him forget the pain in his head for a couple of moments. Liz Linshaw was a dream. He hauled up his wrist and looked at his watch, which evidently he had been in no state to remove the previous night. 12:15. He spotted his clothes hanging on the door of the tiny guest room and groped his way out of bed toward them. The door was open a crack. Beyond, he could hear kitchen sounds. The smell of coffee and toast wafted under his nose. He dressed hurriedly, stuffed his tie in his jacket pocket, and picked up his shoes. Outside the guest room, a white-painted corridor hung with innocuous landscapes led to a wide, curving staircase. Halfway down, he met a woman coming up. Auburn hair, light eyes. He made the match with Michael's wallet photo. Suki. Suki had a cup of coffee, complete with saucer, in her hand, and there was a tolerant smile on her perfectly made-up face.
"Good morning. It's Chris, isn't it? I'm Suki."
She offered one slim, gold-braceleted arm.
"Nice to meet you at last. I was just bringing this up to you. Michael said you'd want to be woken. He's in the kitchen, talking to work, I think."
Chris took the coffee, balancing it awkwardly in his free hand. His head was beginning to pulse alarmingly.
Thanks.
Suki's smile brightened. Chris had the disturbing impression that his hands and face could have been painted with blood and she would have smiled the same way.
"Had fun last night, did you?" she asked maternally.
Something like that. Would you excuse me?"
He slipped past her and found his way down into the kitchen. It was a large, comfortable room with wooden furniture and tall windows along one wall letting in the sun. The scrubbed wooden table was laid for three and covered with an assortment of edible breakfast items. At the far end, a 2-year-old child sat in a high chair, belaboring a plate of unidentifiable sludge with a plastic spoon. Over by the window and well out of splash range, Mike Bryant watched her with a tender expression on his face and drank coffee out of a mug. There was a cell phone pinned between his ear and shoulder, and he appeared to be listening intently. He nodded and waved as Chris came in.
"They certainly were. What, you think I imagined it? Who says that? Right, get him on the line."
Bryant cupped a hand over the phone.
"Chris, call your wife at work. She's been screaming down the Shawn switchboard since 8 this morning. You sleep well?"
He pointed at a video phone hung on the wall near the door. Chris put down his coffee, picked up the phone, and dialed from memory. He waved at Ariana, who regarded him in silence for a moment, and then grinned and started bashing her breakfast again. Bryant went back to his conversation.
"Yes, this is Michael Bryant. No, I'm not. I'm at home, which is where I'm likely to stay until you can promise a little more safety on the streets." "I don't care. We don't pay you people to stand around scratching your balls. We were less than three—" "Don't shout me down, detective. 3 clicks inside the cordon." "Yes, you're fucking right. I shot them."
The screen in front of Chris lit up with a grimy, gum-chewing face.
"Yeah? Mel's auto-fix?"
He caught sight of Chris.
"Need a tow?"
"No," Chris cleared his throat. "Could I speak to Carla Nyquist, please?"
"Sure, be a moment."
Behind him, Bryant went on with his tirade.
"They were just about to take me and my colleague to pieces with machetes." "What?" "Well, I'm not surprised. Probably got scavenged by someone last night. Listen, there were 5 of them to 2 of us, hardcore gangwits. Now, if I can't claim that as self-defense, then—"
Carla appeared, knuckling grease across her nose. There was a fairly obvious scowl under the black marks.
"What happened to you, then?"
I've stayed over at Mike's place. There was some—" He glanced at Bryant, who was listening to the other end of his own call with a face like thunder. "Trouble."
"Trouble? Are you—"
"No, I'm fine." Chris forced a grin. "Just a headache."
"Well, why didn't you call me? I was worried sick."
"I didn't want to worry you. It was late, and I was going to call first thing this morning. Must have overslept. Look," he turned to Bryant again, "Mike, are you going into Sean today?" Bryant nodded glumly, covering the phone mouthpiece again.
"Looks like it. I've got to fill out 50 fucking incident reports, apparently. Say now."
Chris turned back to Carla's waiting face. "I'm going in to pick up the car with Mike in about an hour. I'll pick you up from the garage and tell you all about it then, okay?"
"Okay."
It was grudging.
"But this had better be a fucking good story."
"Deal. By the way, I'm in love." Mike Bryant shot him a peculiar glance across the kitchen. On screen, Carla kept her scowl.
"Yeah, yeah. Me too. See you at 4, and don't be late."
She reached for the phone and the image faded. Chris turned just in time to catch the last of Bryant's call.
"Yes, I am aware of that, detective. Well, next time I'm attacked on the street, I'll be sure and remember it. Goodbye."
He snapped the phone angrily shut.
"Arsehole. Get this. The corporate police, our fucking police, want to conduct an investigation into whether this was an unlawful shooting. I mean," he gestured helplessly, lost for words, "defend yourself and you're fucking breaking the law. Meanwhile, some piece of shit gangwit cracks a fingernail in a back alley and you've got citizens' rights activists screaming for someone's neck. What about us citizens? Who's looking out for us? What about our rights?"
"Michael," Suki appeared in the kitchen doorway, a coffee cup in each hand, "how many times have I told you, don't use that language in front of Ariana? She just comes right out with it at the playgroup, and I get dirty looks from the other mothers."
She put the coffee cups on the table and went to clean some of the surplus food from around her daughter's mouth. Ariana made a half-hearted protest, all the time squinting shyly at Chris.
"That's right. Don't you listen to Daddy when he talks like that."
She turned a fraction of her multitasked attention in the same direction as her daughter.
"Take no notice, Chris. He's always moaning about citizens' rights. This will be the second time he's been in trouble. There, is that better, darling? The second time he's been in trouble with the police this year. Use of undue force. Yes, who's a clean girl? I think he just likes living dangerously."
Bryant made a disgusted noise. Suki went to him and put an arm around his waist. She kissed him under the chin.
"Maybe that's what I see in him. You're married, aren't you, Chris? Was that her on the vid?"
"Yeah." To Chris, his own voice sounded unfairly defensive.
"She's a mechanic. Got to work most Saturdays."
He sipped his coffee and watched for a reaction, but Suki either didn't care one way or the other, or had been trained to black belt in social graces. She smiled as she unfastened Ariana from the high chair.
"Yes," Michael said. "You know, one of the Sean partners had a girlfriend who worked in auto reclaim. Now, what was his name?"
She snapped her fingers.
"I met him at the Christmas bash."
"Notley," said Bryant.
"That's it, Notley, Jack Notley. Well, you must both come over for dinner, Chris. What's your wife's name?"
"Carla."
"Carla. Lovely name. Like that Italian holler porn star Mike gets so turned on over."
She put a playful hand over Bryant's mouth as he protested.
"Yes, ask her to come over. In fact, why don't you come over tonight? We've got no plans, have we, Mike?"
Bryant shook his head.
"Well then, I'll cook sukiyaki. You're not vegetarian, either of you?"
"No." Chris hesitated. There had been some notion of going to visit Carla's father today, and in the whirl of the week just gone, he wasn't sure quite how solidified the plan was.
I'm not sure if—" "Not to be missed, that sukiyaki,"
said Michael, draining his coffee and setting down the mug.
"Beef, direct from the Sutherland Croft Association herds. Hey, you reckon Carla'd like a look at the BMW? Seeing as she's a mechanic and all. That's the new Omega injection series under the bonnet. State of the art, not even on general release outside Germany yet. I bet she'd love to watch it turn over."
Chris, aware suddenly of the exact depth to which he did not want to visit his father-in-law, made a decision.
"Yeah, she'd like that," he said.
"Good. That's settled, then," Suki said brightly. "I'll get the beef this afternoon. Shall we say about 8:30?
Mike insisted on dropping Chris right beside his car. The underground parking decks beneath the Shawn block were largely deserted, and the level Chris had parked on showed only three other vehicles. Bryant slewed to a halt across the battery of empty spaces opposite, killed the engine, and got out.
"Hewitt's," he said, nodding at the nearest of the isolated vehicles. "Audi built it for her to spec when she made partner. Fancy seeing that coming up in your rear view?"
Chris looked at it. Broad black windshield, heavy impact collision bars that jutted from the end of the raked hood. "Not much," he admitted. "But I thought Hewitt was a BMW fan." Mike snorted.
"Hewitt's a fan of money. Bet when she made partner, Sean had this deal with Audi. They supplied all our company cars and hardware, and the partners got special edition battle wagons thrown in for free. 2 years ago, BMW made Sean a better offer, and they went with it. As a partner, Hewitt can opt for any vehicle she likes, but when this baby gets written off or superseded, you can bet she'll just take a top-of-the-line Omega with all the armor options, free to partners of BMW clients. To her, it's all just a cost-benefit analysis."
"So what does Notley think of all this?"
"Notley's a patriot," Mike grinned. "I mean, in the real, uncut sense of the word. Last of the die-hard anti-Europeans. Anti-American, too, come to that. He actually believes in the cultural superiority of England over other nations. Shit like that. I mean, you'd think he'd be able to see a little more clearly from the 50th floor, wouldn't you? Anyway, when he made partner, he didn't want to know about the German makes. He had Land Rover build him a customized battle wagon from scratch, and he's still driving it 10 years later. Fucking thing looks like a tank, but it'll do nearly 200 kilometers an hour. Except he won't use metric, so that'd be, what, about 120-something miles an hour? Whatever, that's what his speedo reads in."
"Yeah, right."
"No, really. He made them fit an imperial speedo, miles per hour. Ask him to let you look at the dashboard sometime."
"He's not here today?"
"No way. You won't catch Notley working weekends. Calls it the American disease, working all the hours God sends you."
Bryant's eyes flicked away with recollection.
"I remember one quarterly do. I ran into him in the men's room. We were both pretty pissed, and I was asking him if being a partner was really worth all the extra shit. The weekend work, the all-nighters, and he looked at me like I was insane. Then he says, still treating me like I'm a head case, talking very slowly, you know, he says, 'Mike, if you make partner and you're still working weekends, then there's something wrong somewhere. You make partner so they can't tell you to do that shit anymore. Otherwise, what's the point? You believe that?'
Sounds like a decent philosophy."
"Yeah, not like the rest of these fucking wannabes."
Mike gestured around dismissively. He wandered across to Chris's car.
"So, what have we got here? This looks Scandinavian to me."
"Yeah."
Chris laid a proprietary hand on the car's flank. "Saab Combat chassis. Carla's family are Norwegian, but she did her apprenticeship in Stockholm. Been around Saabs and Volvos all her life. She says the Swedes were building cars for road raging decades before anybody even thought of it." Bryant nodded.
"It looks pretty mean. But I reckon you'd still lose on speed to an Omega."
"She's faster than she looks, Mike. A lot of that bulk's Volvo's spaced armoring, strut-braced stuff. It isn't solid, and the slipstream channels through flues on the outer edges for stability, but by Christ you'd still know if it hit you. Volvo crash-tested the struts at airplane speeds, and they hold."
"Spaced armoring, huh?"
Bryant looked thoughtful for a couple of moments, and Chris had the unsettling sensation that he had given away something important to the big man. Then another grin swept the calculating expression out of his eyes. He clapped Chris on the shoulder.
"Remind me to divorce Suki and get a Swedish mechanic to shack up."
The parking deck was filled with a soft chime. The shorn elevator voice announced 2 o'clock for the whole building. Mike glanced reflexively at his watch.
"That's me," he said sourly. "Look, Chris, I'd better run.
Corporate police can be a real drag when they're determined to do something by the book. See you tonight, all right?
Yeah. Chris watched him stride away toward the double doors that led upward into the Shawn Tower. Hey, Mike.
Yup.
Good luck. Bryant raised a hand and waved it sideways.
Ah, don't worry about it. Piece of piss. Be out of here by 3. See you tonight.
He said what?
Carla paused in the act of fastening one earring and stared disbelievingly at Chris in the mirror. Chris looked back at her, confused. He said it'd be a piece of piss and they'd...
No, before that. That stuff about divorcing Suki.
He said to remind him to get a divorce so he could shack up with a Swedish mechanic. Chris saw the look on her face and sighed, feeling the edge of the argument they were teetering on.
He's just trying to be friendly, Carla. It's a kind of compliment, you know.
It's a load of sexist shit is what it is. Anyway,
Carla finished with the earring and came away from the mirror.
That's not the point.
No? Then what is the point, Carla? This time it was Carla who sighed.
The point, she said heavily, is that I'm not some curiosity for you to show off. This is my wife. By the way, she's a mechanic. I'm sure it's fun to say, the shock value, the looks you get. I know you get a kick out of taking me to these corporate functions, showing everyone what a rebel you are.
Chris stared at her.
No, it's because I love you.
She'd been about to raise her voice. Something broke in the effort.
Chris, I know that. I know. You don't have to prove it against overwhelming odds all the time. It's not a battle or a quest. It's just living.
She saw the pain flit across his face and went to him. Her hands, scrubbed clean with aromatic oil, cupped his downturned face.
I know you love me, but I'm not here just to be loved. You can't use me as a statement of how strongly you feel about everything, how loyal you are.
He tried to turn his head away. She held it in place.
Look at me, Chris. This is me. I'm your wife. Mechanic is just a job, just a statement of financial disadvantage. I don't let it define me, and I don't want you doing it behind my back. We're more than what we do.
Now you sound like your father. She paused for a moment, then nodded and let go of his head.
Yeah, you're right.
She touched her throat.
Should be fucking mic'd up, huh? And that reminds me, you said we'd go and see him this weekend. Whatever happened to that promise?
I didn't think we'd...
Oh, forget it. I don't really want to go anyway. I don't feel up to the refereeing. Once you two get at each other's throats...
She sighed again.
Look, Chris, about this mechanic thing, how would you like it if I dragged you over to see Mel and Jess and said you'd just love to have a look at their tax returns?
Chris's eyes widened with outrage.
I'm not a fucking accountant.
Carla grinned and dropped into a defensive boxing stance.
Want to bet? Want to fight about it?
The bravado ended in a shriek as Chris hurled himself at her and rugby tackled her back onto the bed. The brief tussle ended with Chris straddling Carla's body and struggling to hold her flailing arms at bay. He could feel the strength leaking out of his grip in giggle increments.
Shh! Stop it! Stop it! Behave yourself! We're going out!
Fucking let go of me, you piece of shit!
She was laughing as well, breathlessly.
I'll claw your fucking eyes out!
Carla,
Chris said patiently, that's not really an incentive.
You've got to learn the art of negotiation. Now!
An incoherent squeal. Carla tumbled him. They grappled at each other across the bed. Chapter 8. Out, driving through Hawkspur Green in the waning light of evening, while Carla tried to do something with her dishevelled hair. The sex had taken half an hour, and it still lurked in grins at the corners of their mouths.
"We're going to be late," Chris said severely.
"Ah, bollocks!"
Carla gave up on her hair and settled for pinning it, untidily up.
I don't know why we're doing this anyway. Going out to dinner with some guy you're going to wreck in a couple of years' time, it doesn't really make sense, does it?"
Chris glanced across at her, the implied confidence in the remark warming him inside. There was always an intimacy to the conversations they had while driving, maybe born out of the secure knowledge that the car was clean. Carla swept for bugs on a regular basis, and her knowledge of the Saab meant they were sure of their privacy in a way they never quite could be at home. "You know it might not come to that," he said, feeling his way through his own thoughts. "A wreck. We don't have to run for the same promotions."
"No, but you will, like at Hammett McCall. It always works out that way."
"I don't know, Carla. It's strange. It's like he's just decided he's going to be my friend and that's it. I mean, there's a lot about him I don't like. That stuff in the zones was pretty extreme."
"No shit. The man sounds like a fucking cracked psycho to me, Chris. Whatever you say."
Without actually lying to his wife about anything specific, Chris had somehow managed to omit Bryant's execution-style dispatch of Molly and her Jacker colleagues. The way it came out, it really had been self-defense against armed and violent attackers. In retrospect, Chris was almost starting to believe it himself. The gangwits had had wrecking bars. Not much doubt they would have used them, if Chris's unloaded gun had given them the chance. Carla remained unimpressed.
"He's just like a lot of the guys at Shawn." "Well, I certainly believe that."
Chris shot her an irritated glance.
"He's worked hard for what he's got, Carla. He just got angry because someone was trying to take it away from him. That's a natural reaction, isn't it? How do you think Mel'd react if someone turned up and tried to trash the workshop?"
"Mel doesn't make his money the way you people do," Carla muttered.
"What?"
"Nothing, forget it."
"Mel doesn't make his money like me and Mike Bryant?"
"I said forget it, Chris."
"That's right, he doesn't, does he? Mel doesn't do what we do. He just makes a living fixing our cars for us so we can go out and do it again.
Jesus fucking Christ, don't you take the moral high ground with me, Carla, because—" "All right," her voice caught on the second syllable. "I said forget it. I'm sorry I said it, so just forget it."
The air between the two front seats frosted with silence. Finally, Chris reached across the chill and took Carla's hand.
"Look," he said wearily, "in the First World War, fighter pilots used to toast each other with champagne before they went out and tried to shoot each other out of the sky. Did you know that? And the winners used to drop wreaths on their enemies' airfields to commemorate the men they'd just killed. That make any sense to you? And we're talking about less than 150 years ago."
"That was war."
"Yeah." Chris made his voice stay calm. "A war for what? Lines drawn on a map. Can you honestly say that those men were fighting for anything that made any kind of sense? Anything that makes more sense than a competitive tender or a promotion duel?"
"They had no choice, Chris. If they laid wreaths, it was because they hated what they had to do. This is different."
He felt his anger twist and jump like a fish in a net. This time it was an effort to hold it down. It looked as if Carla was going to pull her favourite trick and they were going to arrive at the Bryants' front door in the brittle silence of an interrupted argument.
"You think we have any more of a choice than they did? You think I like what I do for a living?"
"I don't think you dislike it as much as you say."
Carla was digging in her bag for cigarettes, a bad sign on the fight barometer.
"And if you do, there are other jobs, other companies. Chris, you could go and work for the fucking Ombudsman with what you know. They'd take you. UNECT, or one of the others. The regulatory bodies are screening for people with real commercial experience."
"Oh, great. You think I want to be a fucking bureaucrat, playing at international social democracy with a fucking placard and a zone-level salary?"
"Ombudsmen make a lot of money, Chris."
"Says who?"
"My mother used to know some of the guys from UNECT in Oslo. Their field agents pull down near 200 grand a year."
Chris snorted.
"Not bad for fucking socialists."
"All right, Chris."
It was cold and even, a flip side of her anger he hated worse than the shouting.
"Forget the fucking ombudsmen. you could get a job with any other investment firm in the city.
Not any more. He hunched his shoulders as he said it. Have you got any idea how much Sean paid to get me out of Hammett McColl? Any idea what they'll do to protect that investment?
Break your legs, will they?
The sneer hurt, not least because it sounded like something Mel might have said in workshop banter. Jealousy flared. He hid it and worked at calm.
Not mine, no. But the word will be out there, Carla. Every executive search company in London would have been warned off me. Anyone who chooses to ignore it, they'll find strung up under Blackfriars Bridge.
She exploded smoke across the car.
Come off it!
No? You don't remember Justin Gray, then?
That was gasoline mafia stuff.
Yeah, right. A recruitment consultant with an apartment in Knightsbridge and a house in St. Albans is really going to get mixed up with those clowns. Everybody believed that one.
Wearing a suit doesn't make you smart, Chris. It just makes you greedy.
Thank you.
That's not what I meant, and you know it.
Look, 2 weeks before he died, Gray was instrumental in moving two senior cutting-edge technologies execs out of Sean and into Calder's UK. He told the police he'd been receiving death threats throughout the run-up to that deal. Conveniently enough, they failed to investigate.
I think you're talking wine bar dramatics and a coincidence, Chris.
Suit yourself. Gray's not the only one. There was that guy they found floating in his swimming pool in Biarritz last year, another one a couple of years before that in a car smash.
Mistaken dual call-out, they said, like that happens all the time, both chasing candidates at Sean. Coincidence? I don't think so, Carla. Over the last 5 years, there have been at least a dozen executive search personnel who've ended up dead or damaged, while coincidentally they were trying to prise candidates away from Sean.
So why'd you go to work for them?
She snapped.
Chris shrugged. It was a lot of money, remember?
We didn't need it.
We didn't need it right then. These days that means nothing. You can't ever be backed up too much. Besides, Sean aren't the only ones to play rough with the wreckies.
He found he was smiling faintly.
They're just better at it than most. More prepared to go to the asphalt, quicker to floor it when they do. Just a harder crew, that's all.
Yes, and that's really it, isn't it, Chris?
There was ice in her voice. She'd caught the smile.
It wasn't the money. It was the rep. You couldn't wait to get in the running with a hard crew, could you? Couldn't wait to test yourself against them.
All I'm saying is when you talk about choices, face the facts. Be realistic. Realistically, what choice do I have?
You always have a choice, Chris. Everyone does.
Yeah?
Finally, his anger slipped its leash.
Have you listened to any fucking thing I've said, Carla? What fucking choice do I have? You could resign.
Oh, good idea.
This time there was a break in his voice that he couldn't iron out.
And then we could go and live in the zones. And when your father gets threatened with eviction again, instead of paying off what he owes, we could just be poor and helpless and maybe go and help him pick his possessions up off the street where they throw them. Maybe you'd like that better.
Carla flicked ash off her cigarette and stared out the side window.
I'd like it better than waiting to see this car on fire on the 6 o'clock news.
That isn't going to happen.
He said it reflexively.
Isn't it?
Now he could hear the unshed tears in her throat. She drew hard on the cigarette.
Isn't it? Why is that, Chris?
Silence. And the sound of the Saab engine. Mike grinned. Laughter erupted around the table. 2 hours earlier, Chris would have been willing to bet that he wouldn't hear Carla or himself laugh for the whole weekend. But here he was, seated in soft candlelight, watching across a food-laden black wooden tabletop as his wife broke up in peals of genuine hilarity. Against all the odds, the evening with the Bryants had taken off like a deregulation share issue.
No, really?
Suki fought her own laughter down to a smirk.
He actually said that. Can you believe it? Would you have gone out with a man who said that to you? No, I wouldn't,
Carla was still laughing, but her answer was absolutely serious.
Oh, Suki reached across the table and took her husband's hand. I'm being horrible, aren't I? Tell us how you met Chris, Carla.
Carla shrugged. He came in to get his car fixed. The laughter rekindled. Chris leaned forward.
No, it's true. You know, she was standing there in this T-shirt.
He made vague female body gestures with both hands.
With a wrench in her hand, grease on her nose, and she says, I can give you the best road holding in Europe. And that was it. I was gone. Falling.
Carla lost a little of her mirth.
Yeah, what he doesn't tell you is he was beaten up from some fucking stupid competitive tender. He was falling. He could barely stand. Torn suit, blood on his hands, down his face, trying all the time to make believe he wasn't hurt.
Hmm, Suki drawled with a grin.
Gorgeous.
Carla's smile faded slightly.
No, not really. Oh, come on, Carla. I bet that's when you fell for him as well. Noble savage and all that caveman stuff. Just like that Tony Carpenter flick, you know, the one where he fights off all those motorcycle thugs. What's it called, Michael? I can never remember the names of these things.
Graduate intake, said Mike Bryant, eyes intent on Carla's face.
Chris nodded.
Seen it. Great movie.
That kind of macho shit doesn't turn me on, Carla said flatly. I see too much of the results working salvage. See, they haven't always finished pulling the bodies out by the time we get there.
Carla's boss spends a lot of time separating losers from their vehicles, said Chris, miming a pair of salvage shears.
Literally.
Chris!
Suki laughed again, then put one elegantly varnished set of fingernails over her mouth, in mock mortification, as if she'd just realized what she was laughing at.
Please!
Okay, here's a joke.
Chris ignored the look Carla was giving him.
Who are the lowest-paid headhunters in the city?
Oh, I know this one. Suki wagged a finger at them. Don't tell me, don't tell me. The guys at Costermans were telling this a couple of months ago. Oh, I can't remember, Chris. Go on, then.
Paramedic crews on the orbital after the New Year's playoffs.
Suki's brow creased in fake pain.
Oh, that's awful, she sniggered, winding up to another full-blown laugh. That's horrible!
Isn't it just? Carla said unsmilingly, staring across the table at her husband. Mike Bryant coughed.
Would you like to see that Omega now, Carla? It's just through the kitchen to the garage. Bring your glass, if you like.
He got up and flashed a glance at Suki, who nodded on cue.
Yes, go on. I'll clear these away.
I'll help you,
said Chris, standing automatically.
No, it's just loading the machine. You can help me make the coffee later. Go on, I don't know the first thing about engines. Michael's been dying to show it off to someone who understands what he's talking about.
Suki reached across and kissed Bryant.
Isn't that right, darling?
Well, if you're sure.
Chris broke off as Carla tugged at his sleeve, and the three of them trooped out after Bryant, leaving Suki at the table. They crossed the kitchen space, and Bryant threw open a door that let in a wave of cold air and a view of a wide, concrete-floored garage. The BMW stood gleaming in the light from overhead neon tubes. They filed through the door and stood around the hood end of the vehicle while Mike Bryant reached in and popped the locks. Then he set aside his wine glass on a workbench and lifted up the hood. Service lights sprang up in the engine space, and the Omega injection was revealed in all its matte grey glory.
"Ain't that a beautiful sight?"
Bryant burlesqued, some mutilated sub-Simeon Sands idea of an American accent.
"Very nice,"
Carla walked around the engine, peering down into the clearance on either side. She pressed down hard with one hand on the engine block and nodded to herself. She looked up at Bryant.
Cantilevered support?
Got it in one.
Looks like they've mounted the weight a long way back this time.
Yeah, well, you probably remember the gammas.
Bryant came to lean into the engine beside her, leaving Chris feeling suddenly, unreasonably isolated.
Never drove one myself, but that was the big complaint, wasn't it? All that nose armor in the engine, too.
Carla grunted agreement, still groping around down the side of the engine.
Yep, handled like a pig. This one doesn't, I imagine.
Bryant grinned.
You want to take it for a spin, Carla?
Put her through it?
Well, I...
Carla was clearly taken aback. She was saved an answer by Suki, who appeared in the door with her hostess' smile and a silver foil packet in one hand.
How many for coffee, then?
Leave it, Suki.
Bryant went to her and took the packet away. We're all going to go for a ride.
Oh, no, Michael.
For the first time that Chris could detect, he saw a crack in Suki's social armor.
You've drunk too much. You're just going to get someone killed.
No, Carla's going to drive.
Oh, I'll believe that when I see it. Carla, honestly, the number of times he's let me behind the wheel, then yanked me out again at the first serious sign of...
Don't listen to her, Carla.
Suki, it's the weekend. It's nearly midnight. There's nothing on the roads. Just out on the orbital, as far as the M-11 hookup. Carla drives there, I'll drive back.
Come on, it'll be fun.
True to Mike's prediction, the orbital was a ghost highway. Nothing more substantial than waste paper stirred beneath the march of gull-winged sodium lamps. There was no sound other than the rush of their tires on the asphalt and the comfortable growl of the Omega injection engine. Carla drove with a rapt expression on her face at a rock-steady 150 kilometers an hour, occasionally swerving from lane to lane as chunks of decaying surfacing flashed toward them. A faint rain fell on the big oval windshield, cleaned off meticulously by the gapped speed wipers.
"Crawler," said Mike Bryant from the passenger seat, as the tail lights of a transporter appeared on the sweep of motorway ahead of them. "Looks like it's automated. Only a machine drives in the slow lane with this much road to play with. Pass him close. See if he can trip the collision systems."
Next to Chris in the back, Suki sighed.
"You are such a child, Michael. Carla, just ignore him."
The BMW flashed past the transporter, giving it a wide berth. Mike shrugged. Up ahead, the lights of a junction glowed like a UFO landing site. A massive metal sign announced the M-11 ramp. Carla pulled across into the filter lane and eased off the accelerator, letting the BMW's speed bleed away on the approach slope. They cruised to a gentle halt at the summit just short of the roundabout. Carla sat for a moment, listening to the engine run, then nodded.
"Very smooth,"
she said almost to herself.
"Isn't it?"
Mike Bryant cracked open his door.
"Swap places. There's a couple of things I want to show you."
Carla met Chris's eyes in the rearview mirror for a moment, then she got out and walked around the front of the car, passing Bryant halfway. Bryant high-fived her, came around, and fastened himself into the driver's seat with a broad grin. He waited until Carla had also belted herself in, then dropped the car into gear and revved hard against the parking brake. Chris heard the wheels spin and shriek. For a moment the BMW held position, then Bryant knocked off the brake and they leapt forward.
"Always forget that bit,"
Bryant shouted above the engine and grinned in the mirror. The car plunged down the ramp opposite, gathering speed, and hit the main roadway of the orbital at nearly 120. Bryant let them cover about half a kilometer, then slapped his forehead.
"Wait, this isn't the way home."
He grinned again, then hauled on the wheel. Chris heard his feet hit the pedals at the same moment and was just too late to brace himself and Suki as the BMW executed a perfect U-turn dead stop in the center lane.
"Michael," Suki said severely, "stop it."
"Let's try that again,"
said Bryant, and kicked the BMW into another wheel-spinning takeoff. They flashed back toward the intersection, swerving into the slow lane on the slight incline under the bridge. Bryant turned around to look at Chris and Suki.
"Now, you know that—"
They trampled him down with their voices.
"Michael!
Look at the fucking road!
Don't turn—"
In the time it all took to begin saying, Bryant had turned back to a more conventional driver's posture, and they were under the bridge and climbing the incline up on the other side.
"Shit, sorry," he said. "I was just going to say, you know that truck we passed a couple of clicks back?"
The interior of the car flooded with light as the automated transporter cleared the crest of the rise ahead and bore down on them. Suki, Chris, and Carla uttered another multiple yell, and this time Bryant yelled with them louder than anyone. The transporter's robot brain blasted them with an outraged hoot from the collision alert system, and bands of orange hazard warning lights lit up on the cab. Mike's burlesque sans accent reappeared,
cut with wide-eyed, breathless psycho.
"I'm sorry, honey. I guess I just shouldn't have taken all those drugs."
He laughed maniacally, and at the last moment yanked the wheel. The BMW swung violently to the left. They slid out of the path of the oncoming juggernaut and passed the high side of the transporter's wagon, so close that through the side window Chris saw individual dents in the metal surface of the freight container. He heard the hissing explosion of brakes across the night air, and knew that Bryant had just gone ahead and done what he'd asked Carla to do earlier. He'd deliberately tripped the transporter's collision systems. He'd been playing chicken with the machine's reflexes. For fun. Much later, back in his own car, he watched the same stretch of road again while Carla drove them home. Had he been a little more aware of his immediate surroundings, he would have seen Carla open her mouth to speak several times before she finally made up her mind.
"I'm sorry. That was my fault. I didn't..."
"No, it wasn't."
"I didn't think he'd force it, like..."
"He was just making things clear," Chris said distantly. They rode in silence.
"He's good, isn't he?" said Carla after a while.
Chris nodded wordlessly.
"Even drunk, even like that, he's the best I've seen."
She laughed without humor.
"And to think I said you were going to wreck him in a couple of years' time. Jesus, irony or what?"
"Carla, I'd really prefer not to talk about it, all right?" Carla looked sideways at him, eyes narrowed, but if she'd planned to be angry, what she saw in his face drained the anger out of her. Instead, she reached across to take his hand in hers.
"Sure,"
she said very quietly. Chris took up the offered clasp, squeezing her fingers tightly. A faint smile twitched at his mouth, but his eyes never left the road ahead. Chapter 9. In architectural echo of service pyramid theory, the Shawn block had rented out its bottom two levels to a series of shopping and eating units that collectively went under the name Base Camp. According to the Shawn promotional literature that Chris had read, Base Camp provided employment for more than 600 people, and together with the Shawn-owned vehicle repair shops in the basement, was a working embodiment of the virtues of trickle-down wealth creation. Prosperity spread out from the foundations of the Shawn block, like vegetation from an aquifer, said the literature warmly, though the metaphor that occurred to Chris was water leaking from the cracked base of an old clay flower pot. Wealth, in his experience, was not something the people who had it were at all keen to see trickling anywhere. On the street opposite the Shawn complex, the prosperity had blossomed, or leaked, into the form of a tiny corner restaurant called Louie Louie's. Originally set up in the previous century to serve the butcher's market that had once stood where the Shawn complex now loomed, the place had closed down briefly during the domino recessions, and then reopened under new management, supplying coffee and snacks to the post-recessional influx of workers in Base Camp. This much Chris had gleaned from Mike Bryant when they went across for coffee one morning. What he noticed on his own was that the place never seemed to close, and that, whether through inverted snobbery or recognition of genuine quality, the execs in the Shawn Tower sent out to Louie Louie's in preference to almost any other eating establishment in the district. The coffee, Chris was forced to admit, was the best he'd had in the UK, and he derived a further, ridiculously childish satisfaction from drinking it out of the tall styrofoam canister while he stood by the window of his office and gazed down 50-odd floors to the dimly illuminated frontage of the place where it had been made. He was doing exactly that, and bluffing his way through an audiophone local agent call from Panama when Mike Bryant came to call.
"Well, you go and tell El Comandante that if he wants his Panthers of Justice to have bandages and mobile cover next month, he'd better reconsider that stance. All the phones—"
He broke off as someone banged on the half-open door. Turning from the window, he saw Bryant shouldering his way into the office. In the big man's arms were two packages wrapped in fancy black and gold paper. The bottom package was wide and flat,
and about the width of Bryant's shoulders, the top one about the size and shape of two hard-copy dictionaries taped together. Both looked to be heavy. "I'll call you back," Chris said, and clicked the audiophone off.
"Hi, Chris," Bryant grinned. "Got something for you. Where do you want it?"
"Over there," Chris gestured at a small table in the corner of the still minimally filled office space. "What is it?"
"Show you."
Bryant put down the packages and ripped back the wrapping on the flat package to reveal the checkered surface of a marbled chessboard. He grinned up at Chris again, freed the board from the wrapping entirely, and set it straight on the table.
"Chess?"
Chris asked stupidly.
"Chess,"
agreed Bryant, working on the wrapping of the other box. It came loose and he tipped the box sideways, spilling carved onyx pieces across the board.
"You know how to set this up?"
he asked.
"Yeah."
Chris came forward and picked up some of the pieces, weighing them in his hand.
"This is good stuff. Where'd you get it?" "Place in base camp. They were having a sale, 2 for the price of 1. I've got the other one set up in my office. Here, give me the white ones, you do the black."
"Who was that on the phone?"
"Fucking Harris in Panama. Got problems with the Nicaraguan insurgents again, and of course Harris won't make a fucking decision on his own because he's 500 clicks off the action. He's not sure of the angles."
Bryant paused mid-move.
"He said that?"
"More or less."
"So he called someone who's 5,000 clicks off to decide for him? You ought to call in the audit on that guy. What's he on anyway, 3% of gross?"
"Something like that."
"Audit the fucker. No, better yet, call a retender. Let's see him fight for his fucking 3% like we have to."
Chris shrugged. "You know what it's like out there."
"What, better the scumbag that you know?"
"You got it." Chris put the final black pawn in place and stood back.
"Very nice. Now what?"
Bryant reached out to the rows of white chessmen.
"Well, I don't know much about this game, but apparently this is a fairly good way to start."
He moved the white king's pawn forward 2 squares and flashed another grin.
"Your move."
"Do I have to decide now?" Bryant shook his head. "Call me with it.
That's the idea. Oh, and listen, that thing with Harris. I had the exact same shit with him over Honduras last year. Wish I'd called the retender then, but it was a sensitive time. Is this a sensitive time?"
Chris thought about it for a moment. "No, they're plugged up in the jungle somewhere. Nothing going to happen till the rain stops." Bryant nodded.
"Call the retender," he said,
pointing a cocked finger pistol downward, execution style.
"I would. Get that motherfucker Harris either dead or jacked up and working properly for you. You ever been to Panama?"
"No. Emerging market stuff was all farther south. Hammett McColl were into Venezuela. The name. Bits of Brazil."
"Yeah, well, let me tell you about Panama." Bryant offered his grin again, "just for your information. The place is stuffed full of agents who'll do Harris's job twice as well for half the money. You offer 1.5, maybe 2% of total, they'll rip his fucking heart out and eat it. Down there they do the tendering in converted bull rings, gladiator style."
The American burlesque came on full.
"Real messy."
"Delightful," muttered Chris.
"Fuck it, Chris, he deserves it."
Bryant's brow creased with good-humoured exasperation. He held out his hands, palms up.
"That's our investment he's fucking with. If he can't cut it, well, get someone who can. Anyway, not my account, not my call. Speaking of which, I've got some calls to make. You coming out to play tonight? Up for the Falkland again?"
Chris shook his head. "Promised Carla we'd head out in the village. Maybe some other time."
"Okay. What about cutting work early, coming down to the firing range with me after work? Just for an hour or so before you go home. Get the feel of that Nemex, in case you ever decide to put bullets in it."
Chris grinned reluctantly.
"That's not fair. At least I was carrying mine."
"All right, all right. I'll come down and play in the arcade for an hour. But that's all. After that, I'm off. Meet you down there at 6, say."
"Done."
Bryant shot him with a finger pistol and left. Chris stood and looked at the chessboard for a while. Then he moved the Black King's pawn hesitantly out 2 spaces, so it was faced off against its white counterpart. He frowned over the move, shifted the piece back a space.
hesitated some more, then pulled an irritated face and restored the pawn to the face-off position. He went back to his desk and stabbed rapidly through a number from memory.
"Panama Trade and Investment Commission," said a Hispanic woman's voice in English.
The speaker swam into focus on the screen and recognized him.
"Señor Faulkner, how can we help you?"
"Get me tendering," said Chris. "I don't know," he told Carla that evening over margaritas and fajitas in the village Tex-Mex. "I thought after that shit on the orbital last week the battle lines were drawn. I felt like a fucking idiot for all that stuff I'd been saying to you about us staying friends. But I was right. He wants to be my friend."
"Or he's scared of you."
"Same difference.
I seem to remember someone telling me once that same-sex friendships are just a way of negating competition. Now who was that?"
"I didn't say that. I said that's what Mel thinks. I didn't say I agreed with him." Chris grinned. Well, he'd know about same-sex friendships, I suppose, from a real, in-depth point of view.
"Don't be a jerk, Chris."
"Hey, come on, it was a joke." Chris hung on to his smile, but there was a tiny feeling of slippage somewhere inside him. There had been a time, he was sure, when Carla could read him better than this. "You know I've got nothing against Mel or Jess. A whole stack of the people I worked with at HM were gay. Jesus, Carla, before I met you, I was sharing an apartment with two gay guys."
"Yeah, and you used to make jokes about them."
But the oozing sense of unfairness was already setting in, like cold mud, chilling his mood and tugging his smile away. "Carla, they used to make jokes about me, too. They called me the household het, for fuck's sake. It was all part of the banter. I'm not homophobic, you know that." Carla looked at her food, then up at him.
"Yeah, I know." She mustered a small smile. "I'm sorry. I'm just tired."
"Who fucking isn't?" Chris took an overly large pull at his margarita and said nothing more for a while. Fajitas are not a dish to be eaten in resentful silence, and neither of them did much more than pick at the food. When the waiter stopped by, he sensed the mood radiating out from the little table and took the cooling dishes away without comment.
"Any dessert?"
he asked carefully when he returned. Carla shook her head, mute. Chris drew a deep breath.
"No, thanks." He made a sudden decision. "But you can bring me another margarita. In fact, make it another pitcher."
"I don't want any more, Chris," Carla said sharply. He looked at her with a blank expression he knew could hurt her. "Who asked you?" "Pitches for me." He nodded at the waiter, who withdrew with obvious relief. Carla put on her disdainful face.
"You're going to get drunk?"
"Well, looking at the logistics, I would think so, yes."
"I didn't come here to get drunk."
"I didn't ask you to."
"Chris."
He waited, going nowhere near the opening the forlorn fade in her voice had left him. Her shoulders slumped.
"I'm going home," she said.
"Okay. Want them to call you a cab?"
"I'll walk," she said coldly. "It isn't far."
"Fine." He buried himself in the margarita glass as she got up. She hesitated toward him for just a second, barely leaning, and then something stiffened in her carriage, and she walked away from the table. Chris very carefully did not look around